Chapter 8. Cinder and Ash. Toys. Unmasked. The room in the compound they had given over for Perrig's use was of a reasonable size and dimension, and the last of four that had been offered. The other three she had immediately rejected because of their inherent luminal negativity or proximal locations to undisciplined thought groupings. The second had been a place where a woman had died, some 107 years earlier, having taken her own life as the result of an unplanned pregnancy. The adjutant, Gorosp, had looked at Perrig with shock and no little amount of dismay at that revelation. It seemed that no one among the staff of the Eurotas Consortium had any idea the building on Iesta had such a sordid history. But this room was quiet. The buzzing in her senses was abating, and Perrig was as close to her equilibrium as she could be in a place so filled with droning, self-absorbed minds. Running through her alignment exercises, Perrig gently edited them out of her thoughtscape, eliminating the disruption through the application of a gentle psionic null song, like a counterwave masking an atonal sound. She absently touched the collar around her neck as she did this. It was just metal, just a thing, secured only with a bolt that she herself could undo with a single twist. It had meaning, though, for those who looked upon it, for those who might read the words from the Nicaea diktat, acid-etched into the black iron. It was a slave's mark, after a fashion, but one she wore only for the benefit of the comfort of others. It was not a nullifier. It could not hold her back. It was there so those who feared her ability could have her at their side and still sleep soundly, convinced by the lie that it would protect them from her unearthliness. The texture of the cool metal gave her focus, and she let herself draw inward. The last thing she looked at before she closed her eyes was the chronometer on a nearby desk. Hissos and the local lawmen had returned from the Uber several hours ago, but she hadn't seen any of them since the audience with the Void Baron. She wondered what Hissos would be doing, but she resisted the urge to extend a tendril of thought out to search for him. Her telepathic abilities were poor, and it was only her familiarity with his mind that allowed her to sense him with any degree of certainty. In truth, Perrig's desire to be close to Hissos only ever brought her melancholy. She had once looked into his thoughts as he slept, once when he had let down his guard, and there she saw that he had no inkling of the strange devotion the Psyker had for her guardian, no understanding of this peculiar attachment that could not be thought of as love, but neither as anything else. It was better that way, she decided. Perrig did not wish to think of what might happen if he knew. She would be taken away from him, most likely, perhaps even returned to the black ships from where Baron Eurotas had first claimed her. Perrig suffocated the thoughts and returned to her business at hand, eyes tightly shut, her calm forced back into place like a key jammed into a lock. The Psyker knelt on the hard wooden floor of the room. Arranged in a semicircle around her were a careful line of objects she had picked from the debris of the old wine lodge. Some stones, a brass button from a greatcoat, sticky grease paper wrapping from a meat stick vendor, and a red leaflet dense with script in the local dialect of Imperial Gothic. Perrig touched them all in order, moving back and forth, lingering on some, returning to others. She used the items to build a jigsaw puzzle image of the suspect, but there were gaping holes in the simulacra, places where she could not sense the full dimension of who Erno Sig was. The button had fear on it. It had been lost as he fled the fire and the howl of the coleopters. The stones, these he had picked up and turned in his hands, used them in an idle game of throws, tossing them across the shack and back again, boredom and nervous energy marbling their otherwise inert auras. The grease paper was laden with hunger, panic. The image here was quite distinct. He had stolen the food from the vendor while the man's back was turned. He had been convinced he would be caught and arrested. The leaflet was love. Love or something like it, at least in the manner that Perrig could understand. Dedication, then, if one were to be more correct, with almost a texture of righteousness about it. She dithered over the piece of paper, looking through her closed lids at the emotional spectra it generated. Sig was complex, and the psyker had trouble holding the pieces she had of him in her mind. He was conflicted. Buried somewhere deep, there was the distant echo of great violence in him, but it was overshadowed by two towering opposite forces. On one hand, a grand sense of hope, even redemption, as if he believed he would be saved. And on the other, an equally powerful dread of something hunting him, of his own victimhood. Perrig's psychometry was not an exact science, but in her time as an investigator, she had developed a keen sense of her own instincts, and it was this sense that told her Ono Sig did not kill for his pleasures. As that thought crystallized inside her mind, Perrig felt the first fuzzy inklings of a direction coming to her. She allowed her hand to pick up the stylus at her side and moved it to the waiting data slate on the floor. It twitched as the auto-writing began in spidery, uneven text. Her other hand, though, had not left the leaflet. Her fingers toyed with the edges of it, playing with the careworn paper, seeking out the places where it had been delicately folded and unfolded, time and time again. She wondered what it meant to Sig that he cared so much for it, and sensed the ghost of the anguish she would feel at its loss. That would be how she would find him, the sorrow, fluttering from him like a pennant in the wind. The scribbling stylus moved of its own accord, back and forth across the slate. Confidence rose in her. She would find Erno Sig. She would, and Hyssos would be pleased with her. Her heart jumped in her chest, and she gasped. The stylus, gripped beyond its tolerances, snapped in two, and the broken ends dug into her palm. Perrig was suddenly trembling, and she knew why. At the back of her mind there had been a thought she had not wanted to confront, something she took care to avoid as one might favour an ugly, painful bruise upon the skin. But now she was drawn to it, touching the discoloured edges of the psychic contusion, flinching at the tiny ticks of pain it gave off. She had sensed it after their arrival on Iesta Veracrux. At first, Perrig imagined it was only an artifact of the transition of her mind from the controlled peace of her domicile aboard the Yuba to the riotous newness of the planet's busy city. Correction. She had wanted to believe it was that. The trembling grew as she dared to focus on it. A dark shadow at the edges of her perception close at hand. Closer than Erno Sig. Much, much closer. More so than Hyssos or any of the Iestan investigators suspected. Perrig felt a sudden wetness at her nostrils, on her cheek. She smelled copper. Blinking, she opened her eyes, and the first thing she saw was the leaflet. It was red, deep crimson, the words printed on it lost against the shade of the paper. Panting in a breath, Perrig looked up from where she knelt and saw that the room and everything in it was red and red and red. She let the broken stylus fall and wiped at her face. Thick fluid came away from the corners of her eyes. Blood, not tears. Propelled by a surge of fright, she came to her feet, her boot catching the data slate and crushing the glassy screen beneath the heel. The room seemed humid and stifling, every surface damp and meat slick. Perrig lurched towards the only window and reached for the pull to drag back the curtain so she might open it, get a breath of untainted air. The drapes were made of red and shadows, and they parted like petals as she came closer. Something approximating the shape of a human being opened up there, suspended by spindly feet from the ceiling overhead. The heavy velvets thumped to the wooden floor, and the figure unfolded, wet and shiny with oils. Its name impressed itself on the soft surfaces of her mind, and she was forced to speak it aloud, just to expunge the horror of it. Spear! A distended maw of teeth and bone barbs grew from the head of the monstrosity. Stygian flame, visible only to those with the curse of the witch sight, wreathed the abstract face and the black pits that were its eyes. In an instant, Perrig knew what had made all those kills, what hands had delicately cut into Yared Nota, Kirsten the Teague, and all the others who had perished at its inclination. She backed away, her voice lost to her. More than anything, Perrig wanted to cover her eyes and look away, find somewhere to hide her face so that she would not be forced to see the spear thing. But there was nowhere for her to turn. Even if she clawed the orbs from her sockets, her witch sight would still remain, and the aura of this monstrous creature would continue to smother it. Horribly, she sensed that the killer wanted her to look upon it, with all the depth of perception her psychic talents allowed. It projected a need for her to witness it, and that desire drew her in like the pull of gravity from a dark sun. Spear muttered to itself. When Perrig had touched the minds of other killers in the past, she had always flinched at the awful joy with which they pursued their craft. She did not see that here, however. Spear's psyche was a pool of black ink, featureless and undisturbed by madness, lust, or naked fury. It was almost inert, moving under the guidance of an unshakable certainty. It reminded her, for one fleeting instant, of Hissos's ordered mindset. The killer shared the same dogged, unflinching sense of direction towards its goals, almost as if it were following a string of commands. And still it let her in. She knew, if she refused it, Spear would tear her open then and there. She tried desperately to break past the miasma of cold that lay around her, projecting as best she could a panicked summons towards her absent guardian. But as she did this, she also let her mind fall into Spear, stalling for time, on some level repulsed and fascinated by the monster's true nature. Spear was not coy. It opened itself to her. What she saw in there sickened her beyond her capacity to express. The killer had been made this way, taken from some human stock now so corrupted that its origin could not be determined, sheathed with a skein of living materials that seemed cut from the screaming depths of the warp itself. Perhaps a fluke of cruel nature, or perhaps a thing created by twisted genius. Spear was soulless, but unlike any stripe of psionic null Perrig had ever encountered. It was a black pariah, the ultimate expression of negative psychic force. Perrig had believed such things were only conjecture, the mad nightmare creations of wild theorists and sorcerous madmen. Yet here it stood, watching her, breathing the same air as she wept blood before it. And then Spear reached out with fingers made of knives and took Perrig's hand. She howled as burning pain lanced through her nerves. The killer severed her right thumb with insolent ease and drew it up and away, toying with its prize. Perrig gripped her injured hand, vitae gushing from the wound. Spear took the severed flesh and rolled it into its fanged maw, crunching down the bone and meat as if it were a rare delicacy. Perrig sank back to the blood-spattered floor, her head swimming as she caught the edges of the sudden psionic shift running through the killer. The black voids of its eyes glared down at her, and they became smoky mirrors. In them, she saw her own mind reflected back at her, the power of her own psionic talents bubbling and rippling, copied and enhanced a thousandfold. Spear had tasted her blood, the living gene code of her being, and now it knew her. It had her imprint. She scrambled backwards, feeling the humming chorus of her mind and that of the killer coming into shuddering synchrony, the orbits of their powers moving towards alignment. Perrig cried out and begged it to stop, but Spear only cocked its head and let the power build. It had not killed in this manner for a long time, she realized. The other deaths had been mundane and unremarkable. It wanted to do this just to be sure it was still capable, as a soldier might release a clip of ammunition to test the accuracy of a firearm. Belatedly, Perrig understood that she was the only thing for light years around that could have been any kind of threat to it. But now, too late. And then they met in the non-space between them. Beyond her ability to stop it, Perrig's psionic ability unchained itself and thundered against Spear's waiting open arms. The killer took it all in, every last morsel, and did so with the ease of breathing. In stillness, Spear released its burden and reflected back all that Perrig was, the force of her preternatural power returning, magnified into a silent, furious hurricane. The woman became ashes and broke apart. Through the coruscating, unquenchable fires of the Immaterium, the Ultio raced on, passing through the corridors of the warp and onwards beyond the borders of the Segmentum Solar. The ship's sightblind navigator took it through the routes that were little known, the barely charted passages that the upper echelons of the Imperial government kept off the maps given to the common Admiralty. These were swift routes, but treacherous ones, causeways through the atemporal realm that larger ships would never have been able to take, the sole light glitter of their massive crews bright enough that they would attract the living storms that wheeled and turned, while Ultio passed by unnoticed. The phantom ship was barely there. Its Geller fields had such finely tuned opacity, and its engines such speed, that the lumbering predatory intelligences that existed inside warp space noted it only by the wake it left behind. As days turned and clocks spun back on Terra, Ultio flew towards Dagonet. By some reckonings, it was already there. On board, the execution force gathered once more, this time in a compartment off the spinal corridor that ran the length of the starship's massive drives. Kel watched, as he always did. The Garantine was still toying with his makeshift blade. He had continued to craft it into a wicked shiv that was easily the length of a man's forearm.
"What do you want, Vanus?" he asked.
Tariel gave a nervous smile and indicated a large cargo module that replaced one whole wall of the long, low compartment.
Thank you for coming.
He glanced around at Kel, Iota, and the others.
As we are now mission committed, I have leave to continue with the next stage of my orders.
Explain, said Coyne.
The Infocyte rubbed his hands together.
I was given a directive by the Master of Assassins himself to present these materials to you only after the group had been completely assembled, and only after the Ultio had left the Sol system.
He moved to a keypad on the cargo module and tapped in a string of symbols.
I am to address the matter of your equipment.
The Eversaur Assassin's head snapped up, his mood instantly changing from insolence to laser-like intensity.
Weapons?
He asked, almost salivating. Tariel nodded.
Among other things, this unit contains the hardware for our mission ahead.
Did you know about this?
Demanded the Garantine, glaring at Kel.
Here I am, playing with scraps, and there's a warlord right here on board with me.
Kel shook his head.
I assumed we'd be equipped on site.
Why did someone fail to tell me there was an armory aboard this tub?
Tariel ducked as the Garantine threw his shiv and it buried itself in a stanchion close by.
Give me a weapon now! Feels like I'm bloody naked here!
What a delightful image, murmured Solm.
He needs it, said Iota distractedly. He actually feels a kind of emotional pain when separated from his firearms, like a parent torn from its child.
I'll show you torn!
Grated the hulking killer, menacing the Vanus.
I'll do some tearing!
Open!
Tariel fairly shouted the word, and the mechanism controlling the lock hissed on oiled hydraulics. The pod split along its length and rolled back, presenting brackets of guns, support equipment, and other war gear. The Garantine's face lit up with something approximating joy.
Ah, hello, pretty, pretty,
he muttered, drawn to a rack where a heavy pistol, ornate and decorated with metallic wings and sensor probes, lay waiting. He gathered it up and hefted it in one hand. Cold laughter fell from his lips as gene markers tingled through him, briefly communing with the lobochips implanted in his brain, confirming his identity and purpose. The Executor Combi Pistol, said Tariel, blinking rapidly as he drew the information up from a mnemonic pool in his deep cortex. Dual-function ballistic bolt weapon and needle projectile.
I know what it is, snarled the Garantine before he could finish. Oh, we are very well acquainted.
He stroked the gun like it was a pet. Kell spoke up.
All of you, take what you need, but make sure you use what you take. Go back to your compartments and prepare your gear for immediate deployment. We have no idea how long we may have between our arrival and the targets.
He may already be there waiting for us,
offered Coyne, drifting towards a different rack of weapons.
The tides of the warp often flow against the ebb of time.
The Garantine greedily gathered armfuls of hardware, taking bandoliers of melter grenades, a wickedly barbed neuro gauntlet, and the rig for a sentinel array. With another guttural laugh, he snagged a heavy, blunt-ended slaughterer's sword and placed it under his arm.
I'll be in my bunk, he sniggered,
and wandered away under his burden. Iota watched the Eversaur go.
Look at him. He's almost happy.
Every child needs its toys, said Solm. The Culexus gave the Rex a sideways look and then turned away.
Not me. There's nothing here that I need.
She shot the Veninum Poisoner a look, tapping her temple.
I have a weapon already.
The Animus Speculum, yes, said Solm. I've heard of it, but it is an ephemeral thing, isn't it? Its use depends on the power of the opponent as much as that of the user, so I am led to believe. Iota's lips pulled tight in a small smile.
If you wish.
Tariel nervously approached them.
I do have an item put aside for your use, Culexus,
he said, offering an armored box covered with warning runes.
If you will.
Iota flipped open the lid and cocked her head. Inside there were a dozen grenades made of black metal.
Oh, she said. Explosives. How ordinary. No,
he insisted. This is a new technology, an experimental weapon not yet field-tested under operational conditions, a creation of your clade's senior scienticians. The woman plucked one of the grenades from the case and sniffed it. Her eyes narrowed.
What is this? It smells like the death of suns.
I am not permitted to know the full details, admitted the Infocyte, but the devices contain an exotic form of particulate matter that inhabits the function of psionic ability in a localized area. Iota studied the grenade for a long moment, toying with the activator pin before finally giving Tariel a wan look.
I'll take this, she said,
snatching the box from his hand.
What do you have for the rest of us in your delightful toy box?
Coyne asked lightly, playing with a pair of memory swords. They had curved, graceful blades that shifted angles in mid-flight as the Calidus cut the air with them.
Toxin cords,
the Vanus pressed a control, and a belt threaded with glassy stilettos extended from a sealed drum marked with biohazard trefoils. Coyne put up the swords and reached for them, only to see that Solm was doing the same. The Calidus gave a small bow.
Oh, pardon me, cousin. Poisons are, of course, your domain.
Solm gave a tight, humorless smile.
No, after you. Take what you wish.
Coyne held up a hand.
No. After you. Please. I insist.
As you wish.
The Veninum carefully retrieved one of the daggers and turned it in her fingers. She held it up to the light, turning it this way and that so the colored fluids inside the glass poison blade flowed back and forth. At length, she sniffed.
These are of fair quality. They'll work well enough on any man who stands between us and Horus.
The Calidus picked out a few blades.
But what about those who are not men? What about Horus himself?
Solm's lips thinned. This would be the bite of a net to the War Master. She gave Tariel a look. I will prepare my own weapons. There's also this, offered the Venice, passing her a pistol. The weapon was a spindly collection of brass pipes with a crystalline bulb where a normal firearm might have had an ammunition magazine. Solm took it and peered at the mesh grill where the muzzle should have been.
A backed gun, she said, weighing it in her hand. This may be useful.
The dispersal can be set from a fine mist to a gel plug round, noted Tariel.
Are you certain you know how to use that? Said Kel.
Solm's arm snapped up into aiming position. The barrel of the weapon pointed directly at the Vindicari's face.
I think I can recall, she said.
Then she wandered away, turning the pistol over in her delicate pale hands. Meanwhile, Coyne had discovered a case that was totally out of place among all the others. It resembled a world shell more than anything else, and the only mechanism to unlock it was the sketch of a handprint etched into the bony matter of the latch, a handprint of three overlong digits and a jewel thumb.
I have no idea what that may be, Tariel admitted. The container, I mean. It looks almost as if it is...
Xenos, said Coyne with deceptive lightness.
But that would be prohibited, Venice. Perish the thought.
There was a quiet cracking sound as the Calidus's right hand stretched and shifted in shape, the human digits reformed and merging until they became something more approximate to the alien handprint. Coyne pressed home on the case, and it sighed open, drooling droplets of purple liquid onto the decking. Inside the container, the organic look was even more disturbing. On a bed of fleshy material, wet with more of the liquid, rested a weapon made of blackened, tooth-like ceramics. It was large and off-balance in shape, the front of it grasping a faceted teardrop crystal, the sea-green colour of ancient jade.
"What is it?"
Tariel asked, his disgust evident.
"In my quid, it has many names," said Coyne. "It rips open minds, tears intellect and thought to shreds. Those it touches remain empty husks."
The Calidus held it out to Vanus, who backed away.
"Do you wish to take a closer look?"
"Not in this lifetime,"
Tariel insisted. A pale tongue flickered out and licked Coyne's lips as the assassin returned the weapon to the shell. Gathering it up, the Calidus bowed to the others.
"I will take my leave of you."
As Coyne left, Kel glanced back at the Vanus.
"What about you? Or do those of your clade choose not to carry a weapon?"
Tariel shook his head, colour returning to his cheeks.
"I have weapons of my own, just not as obvious as yours. An electropulse projector, built into my cogitator gauntlet. And I have my menagerie, the cyber eagles, the eye rats, and netfly swarms."
Kel thought of the pods he had seen elsewhere aboard the Ultio, where Tariel's cybernetically modified rodents and prey birds and other animals slept out the voyage in dormancy, waiting for his word of command to awaken them.
"Now those things won't keep you alive."
The Vanish shook his head.
"Ah, believe me, I will make sure that nothing ever gets close enough to kill me."
He sighed.
"And in that vein, there are also weapons for you."
"My weapon was lost," Kel said with no little venom, "thanks to the Eversaur."
"It has been renewed," said Tariel, opening a lengthy box. "See?"
Every Vindicare used a long rifle that was uniquely configured for their biomass, shooting style, body kinestics, even tailored to work with the rhythm in which they breathed. When the Garantine had smashed Kel's weapon into pieces out in the Actic snows, it was like he had lost a part of himself. But there, inside the case, was a sniper rifle that resembled the very gun that had been his constant companion for years. Resembled it, but also transcended it.
"Exodus,"
he breathed, stooping to run a hand over the flat, non-reflective surface of the barrel. Tariel indicated the individual components of the weapon.
"Spectroscopic polyimager scope, carousel ammunition loader, nitrogen coolant sheath, whisperhead suppressor unit, gyroscopic balance stabilizer.
He paused. As much of your original weapon as possible was salvaged and reused in this one. Kell nodded. He saw that the grip and part of the cheek plates were worn in a way that no newly forged firearm could have been. As well as the long rifle, a pistol of similar design lay next to it on the velvet bedding of the weapon case. Lined up along the lid of the container were row after row of individual bullets, arranged in color-coded groups.
Impressive. But I'll need to sight it in.
We'll doubtless all have many opportunities to employ our skills before Horus shows his face, said Solm.
She hadn't left the room, but stood off to one side as the sniper and the infocyte talked.
We will do what we have to, Kell replied without looking at her.
Even if we destroy ourselves doing it, his sister replied.
The marksman's jaw hardened, and his eyes fell to a line of words that had been etched into the slender barrel of the rifle. Written in a careful, scrolling hand was the Dictatus Vindicare, the maxim of his clade. Exitus acta probat.
The outcome justifies the deed, said Kell.
What he saw in the room was like no manner of death Yosef Sabrat had ever conceived of. The killings of Letigue in the Uranef and Norte at the docks, while they were horrors that sickened him to his core, had not pressed at his reason. But not this. Not this deed. Black ashes were scattered in a long pool across the middle of Perig's room, cast out of a set of clothes that lay splayed out where they had fallen. At the top of the cascade of cinders, a small hill of the dark powder covered an iron collar, the bolt holding it shut still secure, and in among the pile there were the silver needles of neural implants glittering in the lamplight.
I don't understand.
The Garros woman was standing a few steps behind the investigators, outside in the corridor with Yosef, where the Jaegers milled around, uncertain how to proceed.
I don't understand, she repeated. Where did the woman go to?
She had almost said the witch. Yosef sensed the half-formed word on her lips, and he shot her a look filled with sudden fury. Goros looked up at him with wide, limpid eyes, and he felt his hands contract into fists. She was so callous and dismissive of the dead psyker. He fought back a brief urge to grab her and slam her up against the wall, shout at her for her stupidity. Then he took a breath and said,
"She didn't go anywhere. That's all that is left of her."
Yosef walked away, pushing past Skelter. The Jaeger gave him a wary nod.
Heard from Reeves Segan, sir. They called him in from his off shift. He's on his way.
He returned Skelter's nod and took a wary step through the field barrier and into the room, careful not to disturb the cluster of small mapping automata that scanned the crime scene with pictures and ranging lasers. Hissos was crouching, looking back and forth around the walls, staring towards the windows, then back to the ashen remains. He had his back to the doorway, and Yosef heard him take a shuddering breath. It was almost a sob.
"Do you need a moment?"
As soon as he said the words, he felt like an utter fool. Of course he did. His colleague had just been brutally murdered, and in an abhorrent, baffling manner.
"No," said Hissos. "Yes," he said an instant later. "No. No. There will be time for that. After."
The operative looked up at him and his eyes were shining.
"Do you know, I think, at the end, I think I actually heard her."
He fingered one of the braids among his hair. Yosef saw the semicircle of objects on the floor, the stones and the paper.
"What are these?"
"Foci," Hissos told him. "Objects imbued with some emotional resonance from the suspect. Perig reads them." "She read them," he corrected himself absently.
"I am sorry,"
Hissos nodded.
"You will let me kill this man when we find him," he told Yosef in a steady, measured voice. "We will make certain, of course, of his guilt.
he added, nodding.
But the death. You will let me have that.
Yusuf felt warm and uncomfortable.
We'll burn that bridge after we cross it.
He looked away and found the places on the far wall behind him where the markings had been made. On his entry into the room, he hadn't seen them. Like the paintings in blood inside the Aeronef, or the shape that Yared Nauta's body had been cut into, there were 8-point stars all over the light-coloured walls. It seemed that the killer had used the residue of Perig as his ink, repeating the same pattern over and over again.
What does it mean?
Hissos mumbled. The Reeve licked his lips. They were suddenly dry. He had a strange sensation, a tingling in the base of his skull like the dull headache brought on by too much recaf and not enough fresh air. The shapes were all he could see, and he felt like there was an answer there, if only he could find the right way to look at them. They were no different from the mathematical problems in Ivac's Scholar texts. They just needed to be solved to be understood.
Sabret, what does it mean? Said Hissos again. This word.
Yusuf blinked, and the moment vanished. He looked back at the investigator. Hissos had removed something from among the ashen remains, a data slate, the screen spider-webbed and fractured. Incredibly, the display underneath was still operating, flickering sporadically. Gingerly, Yusuf took it from him, taking care to avoid touching the powder-slicked surfaces of the device. The touch-sensitive screen still remembered the words that had been etched upon it and flashed them at him, almost too quickly to register.
One of the words is Sig, Hissos told him. Do you see it?
He did. And beneath that, there was a scribble that appeared to be the attempt to form another string of letters, the shape of them lost now. But above the name, there was another clearly lettered word.
White Leaf. Is that a person's name?
Yusuf shook his head, instantly knowing the meaning.
Not a person. A place. I know it well.
Hissos was abruptly on his feet.
Close? In the low crags. A quick trip by coleopter.
The investigator's brief flash of grief and sorrow was gone.
We need to go there right now. Perig's readings decay over time.
He tapped the broken slate.
If she sensed Sig was in this place, every moment we waste here, we run the risk he will flee again.
Skelter had caught the edge of their conversation.
Sir, we don't have any other units in the area. Backup is dealing with a railganger fight that went bad out at the air docks, and security prep for the trade carnival.
Yusuf made the choice then and there.
When Dake gets here, tell him to take over the scene and keep Lemna occupied.
He moved towards the door, not looking back to see if Hissos was following.
We're taking the flyer.
The operative had lost colleagues before, and it had been difficult then as it was now. But Perig's death was something more than that. It came in like a bullet, cutting right into the core of Hissos's soul. Losing himself in the rush of the dark, low clouds outside the windows of the coleopter, he tried to pass his own emotional reactions to the moment without success. Perig had always been a good, trusted colleague, and he liked her company. She had never pressured him to talk about his past or tried to worm more information out of him than he wanted to give. Hissos had always felt respected in her presence and rewarded by her competence, her cool, calm intelligence. Now, she was dead. Worse than dead. Not a corpse, even. Just dark cinders. Just a slurry of matter that did not bear any resemblance to the human being he had known. He felt a hard stab of guilt. Perig had always given him her complete and total trust, and he had not been there to protect her when she needed it. Now this investigation had crossed from the professional to the personal, and Hissos was uncertain of himself. Looking from the outside in, had he been a passive observer, Hissos would have immediately insisted that an operative in his circumstances be withdrawn from the case and a new team assigned from the consortium's security pool. And that, he knew, was why he had not yet sent an official report on Perig's death to the Void Baron. because Eurytas himself would say the same. But Hissos was here, now, and he knew the stakes. It would take too long to bring another operative up to speed. As competent as locals like Sabrat were, the Reeve seniors couldn't be trusted to handle this with alacrity. Yes, all those were good lies to tell himself, all gilded with the ring of truth, when in fact, all he wanted at this moment was to put Perig's killer down like a rabid animal. Hissos clasped his hands together to stop them making fists. Outwardly, his icy calm did not shift, but inside he was seething. The operative glanced at Sabrat as the flyer began to circle in towards a landing.
"What is this, Whiteleaf?"
"What?" Sabrat turned suddenly, snapping at him with venom, as if Hissos had called out some grave personal insult. Then he blinked, the strange anger ebbing for a moment.
"Oh, yes. It's a wine stock. Many of the smaller lodges store vintage Estufagimi here, holding barrels of it for years so it can mature undisturbed." "How many staff?"
Sabrat shook his head distractedly.
It's all automated."
The flyer's skids bumped as the craft landed. "Quickly," said the Reeve, bolting up from his seat. "If the coleopter dwells, Sig will know we're onto him." Hissos followed him down the drop ramp, into a cloud of upswept dust and leaves caught in the wake of the aircraft. He saw Sabrat give the pilot a clipped wave, and the coleopter rattled back into the sky, leaving them ducking the sudden wind. As the noise died away, Hissos frowned.
"Was that wise? We could use another pair of eyes."
The Reeve was already walking on, across the top of the shallow warehouse where they had been deposited.
"Sig ran the last time."
He shook his head.
"Do you want that to happen again?"
Sabrat said it almost as if it had been the operative's fault.
"Of course not,"
Hissos said quietly, and drew his gun and a portable Auspex from the pockets inside his tunic.
"We should split up then. Search for him."
Sabrat nodded, crouching to open a hatch in the roof.
"Agreed. Work your way down the floors and meet me on the basement level. If you find him, put a shot into the air."
Before Hissos could say anything in reply, the Reeve dropped through the hatch and into the dark. Hissos took a deep breath and moved forward, finding another access way at the far end of the warehouse. Pausing to don a pair of amplifier glasses, he went inside. There was little light inside the wine stock, but the glasses dealt with that for him. The pools of shadow were rendered into a landscape of whites, greys, greens, and blacks. Reaching the decking of the uppermost tier, Hissos saw the shapes of massive storage tanks rising up around him, the curves of towering wooden slats forming the walls of the great Jeroboams. The smoky, potent smell of the wine was everywhere, the air thick and warm with it. He walked carefully, his boots crunching on hard lumps of crystallized sugar caught in the gaps between the planks of the floor, the wood giving with quiet, moaning creaks. The Auspex, a small device fashioned in the design of an ornate book, was open on a belt tether, the sensing mechanism working with a slow pulse of light. The unchanged cadence indicated no signs of human life within its scan radius. Hissos wondered why Sabrat wasn't registering. But then this building was dense with metals, and the scanner's range was limited. The operative's thoughts kept returning to the data slate that Perig had left behind. From the positioning of it among the Psyker's ashes, he supposed that it might have been in her hand when she met her end. She had seen Erno Sig through the foci objects gathered from the Blasco Wine Lodge and tracked him here through the Ethereum. But the other word, the third line of letters on the slate, what meaning did they have? What had she been trying to say? How had she died in such a manner? Finally, he could not let the question lie, and he used his free hand to pull the smashed slate from his pocket.
"Another error in judgment," said a voice in the back of his thoughts.
The data slate was evidence, and yet he had taken it from a crime scene. Pushing back the glasses to his forehead, Hissos studied the broken screen in the dimness. The scribble of letters there were barely readable, but he knew Perig's steady, looping handwriting of old. If he could just find a way to see it afresh, to look with new eyes, perhaps he could intuit what she had been trying to write. Spear. It hit him like a splash of cold water. A sudden snap of comprehension. Yes, he was sure of it. The spin of the consonants and the loop of the vowels. Yes. But what did it mean? The next step he took made a wet ripping noise, and something along the line of his boot dragged at him, as if a thick layer of glue carpeted the floor. Hissos sniffed the air, wondering if one of the mammoth wine casks had leaked. But then the stale, metallic smell rose up to smother the cloying sweetness all around. He dropped the slate back into his pocket and gingerly slid the goggles down over his eyes once more. And there, rendered in cold sea-green shades, was a frieze made of meat and bones. Across the curve of a wooden storage tank, beneath a wide stanchion and in shadow where the light of Aesta's days would never have fallen, the display of an eviscerated corpse was visible to him. The body was open, the skin cut so that the innards, the skeleton and the muscle were free for removal. The fleshy rags that remained of the victim were nailed up in the parody of a human shape. Organs and bones had been taken and arranged in patterns, some of them reassembled together in horrible new fusions. Ribs, for example, fanned like daggers, sticking into the wet meat of a pale liver. A pelvic bone, dressed with intestines. The spongy mass of a lung, wrapped in coils of stripped nerve. All about him, the blood was a matted dried pool, a sticky patina that had mixed with wine spillages and doubtless seeped down through the floor of this level and the next. Thousands of gallons of carefully matured liquor was tainted, polluted by what had been done here. At the edges of the ocean of Vitae, where the fluid ran away, 8-point stars dotted the bland wooden panels. Amid it all, Hissos's eyes caught a shape that focused his attention instantly. A face. He gingerly stepped closer, his gorge rising as his boots sucked at the flooring. Narrowing his eyes, the operative drew up the Auspex, turning its sensoria on the blood slick. It was Erno Sig's face, cut from the front of his skull, lying like a discarded paper mask. The chime of the Auspex drew his gaze from the horror. Hissos had been trained by the Consortium's technologians on the reading of its outputs, and he saw datums unfurl on its small screen. The blood, it told him, was days old, perhaps even as much as a week. This atrocity had been done to Erno Sig well before Perig's execution. Of that there was no doubt. The Auspex could not lie. Swallowing his revulsion, Hissos let the scanning device drop on its tether and raised his gun upwards, finger tightening on the trigger. His hand was trembling, and he could not seem to steady it. But then the footsteps reached him. From across the other side of the lake of dried blood, a shadow detached from the darkness and came closer. Hissos recognized the purposeful gait of the Aestan Reeve, but he moved without hesitation, straight across the middle of it, boots sucking at the glutinous, oily mess.
Sabret,
called the operative, his voice thick with repugnance.
What are you doing, man? Look around, can't you see it?
I see it,
came the reply. The words were paper dry. The amplifier glasses seemed like a blindfold around his head, and Hissos tore them off.
For Terra's sake, Yosef, step back. You'll contaminate the site.
Yosef isn't here,
said the voice, as it became fluid and wet, transforming.
Yosef went away.
The Reeve came out of the dimness, and he was different. There were only black pits glaring back at Hissos from a shifting face that moved like oil on water.
My name is Spear,
said the horror. The face was eyeless and no longer human.